Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Assembly Speaker says his chamber will have its last floor session on Thursday. The state Senate may continue its work until March, but the window is closing for lawmakers to pass new legislation this year.
One major item of business, Republicans, some of them, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers are continuing talks over a potential deal on property tax relief.
A sticking point is the future of a veto by Governor Evers in the last state budget that raised per pupil school funding for 400 years, and the state Senate's leader says he's been left out of the loop.
We're checking in on that story and what else the state legislature might do in the last days of its session with our Capitol Bureau team. Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR State Capitol reporter. Anya, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
And Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau chief. Sean, hi.
Hey, Rob.
Anya, let's start with this property tax thing. Before we get to the details, why are property taxes and the governor's veto tied together at this point?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, you know, property taxes are really high right now, the highest they've been in many years. And everyone kind of agrees on that fact, but they don't really agree on why. So Republicans say it all comes back to Evers' 400-year veto. That is back in 2023 during the budget cycle. He did this kind of famous move during the budget signing. He crossed out some letters and some numbers, and he made what was supposed to be a 2-year increase in school revenue limits last for 400 years. And so effectively what that did is open the door for school districts to raise property taxes without going to referendum indefinitely. And so there's this kind of push-pull here because property taxes are part of how you fund schools. And Evers has said he did what he had to do because Republicans haven't been releasing enough state aid for schools overall. And so that's kind of the tent poles of the negotiations. It's this idea of kind of trading tax relief, which Republicans always want, for more state money for schools.
Sean, the Republican leaders of Wisconsin's Assembly and Senate, people might think, well, they're all Republicans, right? They're all on the same page. Well, hold on. Let's listen to Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux from an interview with Upfront on WISN Milwaukee.
You know, if the Speaker and the Governor really want to get something done and not just score political points or pressure the Senate into whatever they want to do, maybe they should include one house that needs to be part of the process.
So, Sean, what's going on with these negotiations? Voss in the Assembly, Governor Evers, but apparently not the leader of the Senate?
I mean, sometimes we have to read between the lines in these things, but Devin Lemieux is kind of laying it all out there. He feels like Senate Republicans were left out of this, that, you know, we talk about negotiations between Voss and Evers because, you know, we always describe Voss as the most powerful Republican in the legislature. He's been there a long time. He does kind of take the lead when it comes to the Republican position in state government. But there is this other chamber of the legislature. And, you know, when you feel left out, it can prevent stuff from happening. And I think right now, Devin Lemieux feels left out or feels like he's been marginalized. Senate Republicans have been marginalized in these negotiations. So, you know, if they're not all three on board, stuff can't get done. You know, you can't pass it in just the Assembly and call it a deal. It has to get everybody on board.
Anya, sometimes the state of communications between Democratic Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the legislature has been none, right? There have been points where they just don't seem to talk to each other. But you've looked at the communications between Governor Evers and Speaker Voss and their people. There's talking going on. What are the negotiations looking like right now?
Yeah, there has been a real kind of shift in communication. So even just a couple of weeks ago, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he would not kind of consider any type of deal on this unless the veto was repealed. And that's sort of the line that Devin Lemieux is still on. But recently, there has been some movement on the side of Speaker Voss that he wants some kind of relief, even if it doesn't include that repeal. And so the details of those negotiations, according to emails that were shared with WisPolitics, it's basically a $1.3 billion package in all, roughly, drawing from the state surplus. So that would include $550 million toward the school levy tax credit. That's kind of the most direct form of relief for homeowners in there. And then also about $97 million for no tax on tips. So those are kind of the Republican desires right there. And then in exchange, Evers wants $200 million for the special education reimbursement rate and $450 million for general school aid. That's also kind of an indirect form of property tax relief, because that then drives down how much districts can raise because they're getting more state aid.
Sean, with the clock ticking here, basically a week-ish left, you might think, okay, this is the time to do little stuff, loose ends. Big changes to property tax and school funding sounds like a really big thing for them to be tackling at this point in the game, right?
I mean, it is one of the big issues, yes. And I think a reflection of the fact that they are hearing it from constituents, you know, there is an argument that, to be made for Republicans, that if they lose on this, they win in a way. Like, if property taxes are high, they can point to the Democratic governor and say, hey, he did that. But they're not running against Tony Evers, though. Tony Evers is not seeking a third term. They have to go out there. And in the case of Assembly Republicans, there are maybe, you know, 5 to 7 districts where they really need to figure out what their message is going to be. And so in those districts, what do you hear as a pitch to voters from some of these swing candidates? Well, I worked across the aisle. I reached bipartisan deal. I'm willing to compromise. You hear these messages over and over in these 50-50 districts. And so it could be that right now at this late stage, Robin Voss is making the calculation that, hey, this is something that I want to cut a deal on this issue for those lawmakers.
We're talking about negotiations at the state capitol, some last-minute business as the legislative session comes to a close. Sean Johnson is with us, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR State Capitol Reporter. Another unresolved issue in the legislature is online sports gambling. Sean, there's a bill. This is happening all over the country, right? What do we got going in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. It's one of those issues where I think we legitimately do not know how it's going to turn out. You do see all over the country companies like DraftKings or FanDuel. They offer online sports betting. You know, it's basically like going to the casino, but you don't have to go there. You just place these bets on your phone. What the tribes in Wisconsin want is a bill that would allow that, but with the caveat that the servers for these online sports betting platforms would have to be hosted on tribal property. So if a company like DraftKings wanted to do this, they would have to pay a sizable fee to the tribes. So they're pushing for that bill. These companies that have cut better deals for themselves in other states are saying, no, that's not what we want. We want a more open, you know, gambling marketplace, basically. And then you have some conservative Republicans out there, socially conservative Republicans, who say, look, we don't even want to go down the road of expanding gambling. It's a social ill, basically, that we're going to get people addicted to gambling, and we don't want to do that. So very much we do not know how this is going to go. If they pass something on this, it's more than likely going to take a coalition of Democratic and Republican lawmakers, and, you know, that gets tricky.
Anya, another bill you have your eye on relates to Wisconsin Eye, sort of a Wisconsin version of C-SPAN, funding problems there. Bring us up to date on a bill that aims to keep that that eye on the state legislature.
Yeah. You know, whenever I talk about Wisconsin, I have to give a little disclosure, which is that I host a kind of politics roundup show for them, or I should say I used to before these kind of funding issues started happening. Separate from my little corner of things, the really central thing that WISI does is provide kind of, as you mentioned, gavel to gavel coverage of everything that goes on in the Capitol, Senate sessions, assembly sessions, committee hearings, press conferences, Supreme Court arguments, all that kind of thing. They hit this kind of financial hole. They went off the air in December. And so for a few weeks, there was no way of seeing what was going on in the Capitol short of going there yourself. And so lawmakers kind of responded in mixed ways. But then recently there was a bipartisan press conference and then a bipartisan proposal from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Minority Leader Greta Neubauer, who said that they wanted to see WISI come back. And so they've put forward a bill that would establish an endowment to make sure that WISI, you know, doesn't hit these kind of funding issues in the future, with some new conditions attached. So the board would need to be appointed by a mix of Democratic and Republican leadership from both chambers. And then they'd also have to submit an annual financial report. So perhaps a little bit more financial oversight to kind of make sure that this situation doesn't happen again. And in the very short term, a small amount of money has been released so that they are, in fact, back up and running in sort of a more shoestring way.
I want to get each of your takes on this legislative session, the last regular session in a potentially transformative election year. What are your thoughts on the big story? What is the big story out of this session? Sean, let's start with you.
I always try to think about this in terms of, like, if I were to look back at this period 20 years from now, what story I'm going to look at and say, wow, they actually did that. And, you know, it's probably a fool's errand because who knows what we're going to be looking at in 20 years. But for me, it is the budget and the bipartisan deal on the budget between Democratic Governor Tony Evers, Republicans really led by Speaker Voss. It's not the first bipartisan budget we've ever had, but they're becoming increasingly rare in Wisconsin. And this one was very bipartisan, and it was struck in the middle of the night to beat a sort of deadline that was being pushed on states by Republicans who run the federal government. So I was just kind of watching that with my eyes wide as that debate unfolded. That sticks out to me.
Sean, I've got you on my calendar for 2046. Anya, what stood out to you?
Yeah, I also, you know, this is the first session after the maps were changed, the legislative maps were changed to be more favorable for Democrats and to kind of make things more competitive in certain ways. And so I think we saw some interesting kind of power struggles playing out because of that. So, for example, we saw Republicans trying to pass many more constitutional amendments, which is a way of kind of asserting their policy preferences without risk of veto power and kind of getting those enshrined so that if they do lose power in coming election cycles, you know, their laws are much harder to overturn. So I thought that was really interesting. And then certain thematic things that we see, you know, playing out in Washington, really playing out here in Wisconsin. So one of those things being gender issues, tons and tons of legislation around that, that I think we're also going to see being used as an election messaging tool over the course of the next year.
Anya, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, and Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's State Capitol Reporter. We've been talking about business at the State Capitol as the legislative session comes to a close.
Coming up, the White House's prescription drug plan says it provides savings for many consumers. A Milwaukee pharmacist talks about drug costs and digs into the details.
So I was really hoping that this would be truly a solution for our issues, but I think we're still steps away from finding a true solution.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob. Trump administration launched its direct-to-consumer prescription drug website in recent days. TrumpRx had been announced in the fall as part of a deal with pharmaceutical companies.
The White House says it is an effort to lower prescription drug costs for consumers with negotiated discounts from the drug makers.
Those discounts came with the caveat, though. Customers have to pay directly and not go through their insurance.
And they can't already be enrolled in a government insurance program like Medicare. They also can't pursue insurance reimbursement for the out-of-pocket costs or count the expenses toward a deductible. We're getting a better understanding of what impact this new TrumpRx site will have on Wisconsin patients and pharmacies. Hashim Zabok is a pharmacist and CEO of Hyatt Pharmacies, which has 20 locations around Milwaukee in southeastern Wisconsin. Hashim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
When you hear about the federal government starting this direct-to-consumer prescription drug site, how did you react to this news?
To be honest with you, initially I was expecting a lot more. When the announcement was made, it sounded like a terrific idea because definitely we do need to get the cost of medication better here in the United States. Because when I travel to other countries, Canada, Europe, Middle East, I see the prices, the same exact medications made by the same factory for one-tenth of the cost here in the United States. So I was really hoping that this would be truly a solution for our issues, but I think we're still steps away from finding a true solution.
I checked. There are 43 prescription drugs on TrumpRx site, But there are thousands and thousands of prescription drugs all across our healthcare landscape. What do you make of this tiny, tiny fraction? Can it have an impact?
It's going to have very little impact right now because I looked at the 43 drugs that they have listed right now. Many of them are products that have been in generic for many, many, many years. And I've been a pharmacist for 26 years, and I don't remember when the last time I dispensed a brand name Diflucan, for example.
And what does that do?
That's a medication that sometimes it's used for yeast infection. Mm-hmm. And yes, it does sound good because it's reducing the price of the brand name, but nobody's using the brand name. Everybody's getting the generic for $2. So it's not as good as it sounds, but I'm still optimistic. I think that if they work really well and they continue to work on finding the right manufacturers who are willing to work with them, they're going to find better solutions. But like I said, so far, I'm not very impressed.
So from the perspective of a pharmacist, do your pharmacies have much negotiating power with drug companies, or are you more or less forced to sell prescription drugs at the prices that they provide you?
When it comes to the brand name medications, we absolutely have no negotiation power. We have to go by what the wholesalers are telling us, and it's usually a standard price. So it's not that if I go to a secondary or another wholesaler, I would get a better price. So when it comes to a brand name like Ozempic, I'm going to have to buy it from my primary wholesaler, and there is really no negotiation there. When it comes to the generics, yes, if you go from one wholesaler to another, the cost can be 50% or sometimes even 25% of the other wholesalers. So on the generic side, yes, there is a way to get a better deal, but on the brand name, there isn't.
You mentioned Ozempic, and there's been this, you know, just explosion of GLP-1 drugs to treat obesity, which has led to people, you know, buying drugs directly from pharmaceuticals. And I'm wondering, this consumer market for drugs that, you know, is this new? Have we seen this before? And how have GLP-1s changed pharmacy?
Every decade or so, we have a new group of medications there, like the blockbusters, the new ones that really, really make a difference. I don't know if you remember when Prozac came in the market, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was a drug that did not have anything similar to it in the past, and it really made a big difference in the way we treat depression. If you remember Lipitor, when Lipitor came in the market, that was a big, big deal because we were able to take one tablet once a day. And it did magic. It lowered our cholesterol significantly, not just at the individual level, but also at the community level. People were having less heart attacks, less strokes since the introduction of Lipitor and its cousins. There are other drugs that are similar to it. When it comes to blood pressure, there was the lisinopril, for example, when it was first introduced. That made a huge difference because we were able to control the blood pressure with a drug that has very minimal side effects. When metformin or glucophage was introduced, that made a big difference for people who have diabetes because we were able to control diabetes with a tablet taken once a day that has a good impact that really helped a lot of people get their diabetes under control. Mm-hmm. And now with the GLP-1s, it's really a game changer. This group of medication, we see weight losses in 25, 30, 35, sometimes 50%. And that was unheard of before GLP-1s. I mean, I remember, for example, we used to recommend Phentermine before GLP-1s, but you would get like a loss of like 5, 6% of weight loss, nothing close to the GLP-1s. So the GLP-1s really made a huge difference.
Going back to Lipitor, my generic cholesterol medication, my generic Lipitor, cost $0 each month. Zero. Perfect. And it is perfect. So, you know, how well does insurance normally help to reduce the costs for drugs for patients? And is there any potential for savings by not using insurance through something like TrumpRx?
I'll give you a little bit more details about TrumpRx in a little bit. But when it comes to Lipitor on the generic, the cost on it is very low now because there are so many companies that make the generic Lipitor. So even if you have no insurance at all, you can probably get it for less than $10 a month with no insurance. Sometimes you might be able even to get it like a 3-month supply for less than $20. So the issue is not with those generics. The challenge is with the brand name medications that cost a lot of money. And especially now, more than 50% of the drugs that are being introduced in the market today are specialty drugs. Those are the ones that cost thousands of dollars. And we don't have a way right now to reduce that cost because a lot of, obviously the manufacturers are trying to get their research and development cost to make the drug. And then between us as pharmacists and the insurance or the payers, there is a middleman. And that they're called the PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers. Mm-hmm. And they are, in my opinion, they're actually part of the problem because they are collecting those rebates from the manufacturer. They're basically going to the manufacturer, like Pfizer, and they're telling them, if you want your drug to be on our formulary, you have to pay us a rebate. And that rebate can be up to like 30 or 35% of the actual cost of the medication. And we as pharmacists don't see that. The patient himself or herself does not see that. And then the payers a lot of time don't see that. And that goes straight to their pockets. So I think that as a country, we really need to find a solution for this. And we are, by the way, we are the only country in the world that has PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers.
We're talking about prescription drug access and costs and the direct-to-consumer Trump Rx site. Our guest is Hashim Zabok, who is a pharmacist and CEO of Hyatt Pharmacies in the Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin area. Hashim, how often is cost a barrier for patients at your pharmacy? Is it more about the cost of the prescriptions themselves, or is it about the access to insurance? What are some of the barriers you see?
We have a lot of uninsured patients, and those are the ones that are most vulnerable because those are the ones that have absolutely no coverage. Okay. Now, for the people who do have insurance, whether it's private or Medicaid or Medicare, there is a way for them to get the prescription that they need. So if a drug is medically needed or medically necessary, there is a way, for example, to get a prior authorization and get it covered. And there are programs to help with the copays, like if somebody has a high copay, like the drug, let's say a $7,000 drug with a $900 copay, there are programs to help the patients with these copays. I think the biggest challenge is the people who are uninsured. And those are the ones, most of the time, we're able to take care of them with the generics and some of the products that are already available in a generic form. But sometimes they do need some of those expensive medications that don't have generics and they don't have an alternative. And those are the ones that actually cost a lot of money. And a lot of times, unfortunately, they get stuck either by paying a lot of money to get them or going without them.
We've seen, cuts to Medicaid. We've seen the impact of the expiration of the Affordable Care Act federal tax credits. I'm wondering, are you seeing impacts like this for patients? Are they able to afford that insurance now, whether it's on the marketplace or elsewhere?
No, the marketplace place is very expensive unless a person qualifies for some help. But honestly, since the expiration of the ACA, it's been really a challenge because a lot of people lost their Medicaid coverage. So when they go on the marketplace to get their own insurance, it costs them like hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars per month for an insurance with very high deductible. So a lot of people just tell us, I decided to go without insurance this year because of the cost. I could not afford the monthly premiums. And even if I did, the deductibles are so high that there is a pretty good chance I might go this year without hitting my deductible. So what's the point? Mm-hmm. And they're willing to take that risk of having like a catastrophic problem. And they'll be like, you know what, I'll take that risk versus having to pay all this money for the premiums, which is not something I recommend. But unfortunately, when it's the difference between putting food on the table or paying for those monthly premiums, some people will just put the food on the table.
You have been so intentional about trying to address pharmacy deserts with your locations in southeastern Wisconsin. Can online pharmacies reduce some of that transportation barrier as well? Or what impact do you have as a pharmacy in a community that doesn't have one?
The mail order is a good option for a very small percentage of people. Like if somebody is living in the middle of nowhere and it takes them, let's say, 45 minutes to get to the next pharmacy, then mail order might be a good option. But they won't have that one-on-one interaction with the pharmacist. And that's where a lot of the magic happens. That's where you actually can make a change in convincing somebody to be more adherent to their meds, to maybe quit smoking, to start eating healthier, maybe exercise more. That's when you have that emotional connection with the pharmacist, then you're more willing to or more able to make those kind of changes. The mail order is different. It's just like an Amazon. You request a refill for a blood pressure medication, it gets delivered to your house the next day. And if you forget to request the refill on time, then you might go without the medication for a day or two, which, as we know, that's not a good thing.
Hmm. Your pharmacies have multilingual pharmacists, staffers who represent over 20 languages spoken. How much of a barrier is language when it comes to important medical conversations with patients trying to understand their prescriptions?
A lot with the new immigrants, it's definitely an issue. We have pharmacies in Hispanic areas of Milwaukee where more than 70% of our patients just speak Spanish. For example, I have Bernie, and she's my technician at one of the pharmacies. She's wonderful. She speaks Spanish. So when the pharmacist wants to tell the patient something, she'll be the middle person between the pharmacist and the patient in order to translate for them. And a lot of times when Bernie is off, they'll be like, I'll come the next day. I'll come. And then they'll say it in Spanish. And because they just love working with her, because she explains to them things in their first language. And she understands the culture. It's not just the language, because you can use the Google Translate to translate sometimes some what you want to say to the patient. But when you have somebody who can understand your culture, you feel more comfortable with them and you're more willing to follow their advice. Like I tell people, like I was born in the Middle East, so if I speak Arabic, that's my first language. And if I go to a pharmacy or a doctor and they tell me, no, you cannot eat your pita every day anymore. I mean, that's it. Pita.
That's
pita
big.
Bread is like, big. I can't go without my pita bread.
Sure.
But if somebody comes to me and tells me, you know what, instead of eating two, maybe just have one or half. Okay. Mm-hmm. Somebody who understands my culture is going to tell me, is going to understand more how to get to me and how to advise me the right way. Again, there's certain foods, for example, with the Rohingya community. We have a lot of Rohingya patients here. So by the fact that I have Sophia, and she speaks Rohingya, she can connect with them. She can understand some of their challenges, and she can communicate that to the pharmacist. And then we can have a better impact. Same thing applies to any other language. When I'm interviewing people, if the person tells me that they speak another language, that gives them a lot more points during the interview. So there is a better chance of me hiring them. Again, for this reason, because these people who speak only that language will benefit from having that person on staff.
Hashim, we've seen a lot of upheaval around immigration enforcement and growing fears here in Wisconsin. Are you seeing that added stress make it more difficult for patients to go out and get the care they need and stay on their medicine regimens?
We've seen actually an increase in the number of people who want home delivery in the last few months. And I'm assuming some of these people are scared of leaving their homes. So they are requesting the delivery more often, even though they have cars and they used to be able to leave more often, but now they want to stay home. So we have seen an increase in number of people who specifically just want their medications delivered. And of course, that can impact the whole community. We have a few patients who are not coming to the pharmacy anymore. And we were told from other people that the reason is because of what's going on right now with the ICE activity.
Hmm. You have seen decades of healthcare in this country. Are there other initiatives you'd like to see from government leaders or other stakeholders to address prescription drug costs and access. I mean, TrumpRx is this next development, but what kind of steps would you advocate for?
I want some real solutions, not a solution that already existed before TrumpRx. For example, the manufacturer coupons for some of those drugs existed before TrumpRx. So just to say that we invented something new when it's really not new, that's not going to help. Or if we work with the GoodRx, okay, GoodRx existed before TrumpRx. So to say that this is a new thing when it actually a lot of it is just the GoodRx coupon, that's not going to help us. Or if there are companies that have a direct-to-consumer portals where you can actually request your prescription to be shipped directly from the manufacturer's pharmacy. Those things existed before. So to claim that these are new things just to tell the public, oh, we have a solution now, that's not going to resolve the issue. I want to see some real solutions, not a Diflucan that's been in the generic for many, many years, and we have been able to buy it for a couple of dollars for somebody to say, oh, now you can get the brand name at a discount. I don't care about the brand name discount if the generic is available. I want to see some real solutions, real solutions where we can, as the richest country in the world, I want to see our people, whether they have insurance or not have insurance, have easy access to the medications they need.
Hashim, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hashim Zabok is a pharmacist and CEO of Hyatt Pharmacies. He was with us to share his thoughts on improving prescription drug access and the potential impact of the new TrumpRx direct-to-consumer prescription drug website.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin curler who will compete for Team USA at the Paralympic Games in Italy and find out how his path started at a curling club in Wausau.
The club was so welcoming, the members there were so welcoming, and that's partially what got me started.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about foraging food in Wisconsin.
Robin Greenfield gave up going to the grocery store last fall. Now, the Wisconsin native is only eating what he can forage from the land for an entire year. He began harvesting and storing foods last summer and kicked off his year-long quest in October. Wisconsin Public Radio's Danielle Kading met up with Greenfield in northern Wisconsin to find out more.
On a frigid winter day, I walked down a snow-covered path to Robin Greenfield's temporary home on a friend's property in Washburn.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
He invites me into the small dwelling and offers to make some tea. Greenfield says it's made with mint and leaves from basswood flowers that he harvested over the summer in downtown Washburn.
So that's where the basswood flowers are from, and then the mountain mint. This I actually harvested in a park in Maryland. There.
Last year, Greenfield began foraging 100% of his food and medicine for a year. Each day, he makes a pot of food that he eats for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He says food that he's harvested in Wisconsin makes up the foundation of his diet.
This is what I'm eating today, for example. I have wild rice with salmon. There's just, you know, a big chunk of salmon in here from Lake Superior. This has stinging nettle, salt, some herbs and spices.
He says one of the main reasons for his foraging journey is a belief that people are separate from the earth.
And for me, foraging is a way to really deeply connect with the earth, to really find a home here, to really develop the deepest sense of belonging. And it's also a practice of love. As I'm out foraging, I'm falling in love with all of these plants and falling in love with the earth.
He also says it's an act of resistance against what he calls a broken industrial food system. Around 30-40% of the food supply is wasted nationwide. In Wisconsin, around 900,000 tons of food waste were thrown into landfills in 2024. With salmon, for example, Greenfield says he tries to use as much of the fish as possible.
My food is unique from the average person, not because I foraged it all, but because of my desire to utilize it in the way that's the most beneficial to the body and to the ecosystem.
This isn't the first time Greenfield foraged food for a year. 7 years ago, he turned front yards into gardens in Florida. But this time, he's not growing any of his food.
It's food and medicine that is growing without the intentional planting of it by human beings.
Wooden shelves of mason jars contain plants he's harvested for medicinal purposes that include white vervain, hawkweed, and Joe Pye weed. He uses an electric dehydrator to preserve much of his food. Greenfield says he also uses water bath canning for applesauce and a freezer for storing venison and fish as he pulls out a plastic bucket.
These are wild parsnips, and these are stored in a bucket of wet sand, and that keeps these good for multiple months.
Not all of the food he's foraged comes from Wisconsin. He collected water from the Atlantic Ocean in Maine that he made into salt by boiling it on the stove until the water evaporated. He says there's not much he misses, but he has lost some weight.
You know, when you give up the Ben & Jerry's pints, you're going to lose some weight. There's just no way around that.
But he's not too worried about getting sick or dying from anything he's harvested.
It's possible that me choosing to practice this deep level of relationship with the earth and letting go a lot of modern things, that it could end up being my demise. But the odds of that are really unlikely, and we'll take that if and when it happens.
He says his goal is to help more people start foraging for food.
My encouragement to people is just one plant at a time. Learn the foods and medicines, start to incorporate them into your diet.
If more people harvest food in a safe and sustainable way, he says that can benefit the earth and maybe lead to less waste in the landfill.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on forager Robin Greenfield. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
Wisconsin has a strong presence in the Winter Olympics in Italy, and that continues through to next month's Paralympic Games in sports like wheelchair curling.
The Wisconsin Historical Society says Wisconsin's first curling match ever likely happened on New Year's Eve over the Wisconsin River in 1850, and Wisconsin residents have been throwing rocks on the ice ever since.
Matt Toombs of Weston carries on that tradition as a member of the Wausau Curling Club. He joined Team USA in the 2022 Beijing Winter Games. Now he's getting ready to travel to Italy as the skip for the wheelchair curling team at the 2026 Winter Paralympics. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
You started curling, I understand, about 14 years ago. Can you tell us about how you first discovered the sport and tried it out?
Well, I came across Wausau Curling Club. It was advertising for a Learn to Curl in the fall of 2012. And my wife at the time and I decided we could use a little more to do in the wintertime. So we went down and checked it out. So when I got there, a couple of people didn't know anything about curling out of a wheelchair, like, and I definitely did. And so we just did some experimentation on how to throw a rock, and I was hooked. We actually signed up for a league that very day to play the next Monday. That was a Saturday to a Monday, and we were playing already the next week.
What was it about curling that grabbed you right away like that?
I don't know. It was just intriguing. The club was so welcoming. The members there were so welcoming, and it's like we met people that could be, you know, potential friends just by joining the thing. And I actually went home and watched some YouTube videos on wheelchair curling and got a little more insight on how to deliver a stone. So that helped. But it was also just how welcoming a club is. It was a brand new club. They just had built it. It was, the paint was still wet when we went there. And it's just a beautiful place to play. So that's partially what got me started on the initial visit.
I understand the Wausau Club got famous pretty quick for being a welcoming community for curling. Since that time, since you first started, do you feel like there's a para curling community there, a wheelchair curling community that's more than you?
At the time, it was just me. there. And I, about for a couple of years, I did recruit a few other wheelchair curlers. There's a group in Wausau, like an adaptive sports group, that I joined, and we all came down. I talked a few of them into coming down and trying it out. And then we actually had enough for a team. I found three other wheelchair curlers, and I actually had a team for a few years during leagues.
Now, for people who have seen maybe that Olympics curling, but they haven't seen the Paralympic curling yet, what are some of the big differences in how the sport works?
In Olympic curling, they use sweepers to help guide the rock and carry it farther. In wheelchair curling, there's no sweeping. It's just however much weight in the line you put on the rock, and once you let it go, it's all on its own. So that's the major difference, really, is just there's no sweeping in wheelchair curling.
And that sounds to me like it's going to be more challenging, right? Because when that stone starts moving, nobody has any control over it. How much pressure does that put on that initial throw?
You have to be pretty precise. It's a lot of muscle memory into it and a lot of ice reading to just determine how much weight you want to put on the rock when you throw. So it can be, it's a lot of pressure because you have nobody to save you. Sweeping helps make the shot better. So it's quite a bit of pressure, actually.
Now, you're the skip for Team USA's wheelchair curling team, a team captain, basically. What role does that skip play for the team?
The skip generally throws the last two stones in the end, and it helps. They usually help set up, call the right strategy shot, and typically hold the broom for the broom on the other end is for the throwing player to aim at and call the strategy so we get the rocks in the right spot and the score points in the end, generally.
And then that strategy is, you know, on the one hand, you're trying to get your own points, and on the other hand, you're trying to get the other team to not get points by knocking them out. How do you make the decision of, hey, this throw, we're just trying to get it to the middle, this throw, this is about some aggression here on the other team?
It depends if you want to be this defensive. And generally, it depends like what the score is. Then the very first end of game, usually you play pretty clean end where you just keep hitting each other out and then get a few points or stones in the end or in the house. But it all depends on how the stones are lying in the house or in front of the house, if you want to do hits or draw in. So it all depends on how it plays out on the shot prior.
Now tell us about the team. Is this kind of, you know, you're all stars from around the country and you're thrown together, or have you had a lot of time to work together before you head off to the Olympics, the Paralympics?
We are a pretty new team. We have Katie, she's from Montana. Dan Rose is from Denver. Sean O'Neill's from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And Ayuna Urenchamag is from the Twin Cities, Burnsville, actually. Oyuna and I have been playing together for the last, 6 years now, but Katie, Dan, and Sean just joined. Our team was formed in December, so us five have not only been playing together since December, so it is a very new team.
We're talking about curling at this year's Paralympics coming up in Italy with Matt Toombs of Wisconsin, the skip for Team USA's wheelchair curling team. All right, Matt, you're headed to Italy. Who are the teams to beat? Who's the biggest competition for Team USA?
China is a very good adversary. They've been winning gold at Worlds and at the Paras for quite a few years now. They have a pretty solid team. Their skip is very good. Canada is always in the mix. They usually end up qualifying for the medal rounds. And usually have Sweden and Norway are really good teams, so they are very good competition also. So it's like those five are really good competition.
You played for Team USA back in 2022 in Beijing. What is the atmosphere like at these big sporting events?
It's the venues. The Beijing venue was so huge, and the ceilings on and the bright lights. So it's really bigger than you can imagine. Just a space. I like to equate it like when you play basketball for high school, your gyms are pretty small, at least mine was. And then you like go to a like the bucks, and it's so much room behind the backboard that it seems bigger than it is. And then when you go curling, there's so much space behind where the sheets end, it seems longer than it actually is. And so it's just like the sight lines seem bigger, but the sheet of ice is still 120 feet long between the houses. So you just, I just have to tell the new players, it's the same ice, the same, the house is the same size, everything's the same. It's just a larger area and more, a lot more light and people there.
And then what are you looking forward to when you head to Italy for the games later this month? What are you looking forward to in Italy apart from the games themselves?
I am actually looking forward to get some Italian, just the pasta and the food. you know, the where we'll be staying, the mountains, we're in the mountains. So I look, from what I see from the Olympic pictures that are coming back from the teams, it's pretty beautiful. So just the scenery, get some great Italian food. And yeah, that's about it. Just seeing the northern part of Italy.
Now, when you're not training as a Paralympic athlete, you work as an accountant in the Wausau area. What's that work-life balance, especially as you get closer and closer to the event, between, you know, normal life and representing the U.S. at this event?
I am fortunate that my boss and my coworkers allow me to take time off, and they fill in for me when I'm off training and everything. They do work for me and stuff. So it's tough. It's we'll be gone for the next 4 weeks basically. So I'm just very, very happy that my coworkers and my boss allow me to do this. If they wouldn't allow me, then I certainly obviously wouldn't be able to go play in the Paralympics. They're also support me 100% also, so that's also a big help.
As we wrap up, I think interest in curling tends to peak every 4 years with the Olympics. What is your advice to people who are watching it and saying, hey, that looks cool, to actually get out and try it at the Wausau Curling Club or elsewhere in the state?
I'd say sign up for any Learn to Curl, or just come down to a club any night of the week during the winter. There's curling going on, and watch it and talk to somebody from the club. It's a great sport. It's you become family. The club members are great. It's a real welcoming sport. There's a lot of history to curling, a lot of like unwritten rules and that sort of thing. Right before every game, no matter where you are in the world, you always say, you shake the other team's hand and say, good curling, good game. And I say, come down and give it a try. Everybody that comes down is a little leery because you're playing on ice and they're afraid to fall. It's easy to walk on the ice. It's very minimal falling. Come down to try it out. We'd love to have you.
Matt, thanks for joining us and have a great experience when you head to Italy.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
Matt Toombs is a Wisconsin resident and the skip for Team USA's wheelchair curling squad at the 2026 Winter Paralympics. Wheelchair curling starts on March 4th.
Just heard about one sport on ice, curling, and next week we'll check out another, competitive ice fishing.
We'll meet a high school ice fishing team gearing up for a big competition and find out how that works as a competitive sport and what's bringing young people out on the ice.
And we want to hear from Wisconsin's ice fishing community. What do you love about fishing in the winter, and where do you go for solid ice and plenty of fish?
And you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio while you're out there on the ice. Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or call or text at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Lauren Cox, and Royce Padeswa.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is our managing producer, and Dean Knetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.